Well, it's nice to be here among more of the technical end of the audiences that I often address. A month ago, I was talking to the CIA. A month before that, a bunch of educators. And everybody's interested in one basic topic, and that is, what's going to happen? What's going on in the future? In the undiscovered country. And I often start by talking about a field that I have no license in. I have no official background. But still, we live in an era in which we're at liberty to learn about sciences that aren't our own, learn about fields outside of our own. It's one of the miracles of our age, and I hope I get around to talking about that particular miracle. And I'd like to talk about a field that's outside of where I was technically trained, and that is biology. Why do we think about the future? Why do we think we can have any power over it? We care about the future, of course, because of Darwin, because of evolution. We care about what's going to happen, even animals who don't have a concept of tomorrow or of the future. Still do everything they can to prosper in it because those that did that had more descendants. We're all descended from those who succeeded at making tomorrow work for their children, at least long enough for those children to reproduce. Biologically, we seem to be wired to think about tomorrow, to think about the future. We share the cerebellum, the medulla, the lower orders of the brain with fish. We share the mammalian cortex with other mammals. We share the primate cortex with other primates. It's been a process of layering as time has gone on. So what has happened is we did not so much change earlier structures or replace earlier structures as add them. And the most recent addition is one that is not shared even with our closest relatives in the natural world. They are the prefrontal lobes. These are the nubs above the eyes that I'll show you a work of art that shows these what might be an impression of these prefrontal lobes in a little while, in a very surprising context. But these prefrontal lobes, just above the eyes, we now know that these are the organs within which we do what Einstein called the Gedanken experiment, the thought experiment. Einstein himself said that his mathematical derivations of relativity were only half of it, the second half. The first half was just thinking about it, imagining himself riding a beam of light away from the Bern clock tower in Switzerland, and just imagining if he were at 99% of the speed of light or 100% of the speed of light, what this town around him would look like just from the angles that the light would hit him and how long it would take the light to catch up with him. The Gedanken experiment is something that is considered associated with Einstein, and yet we all do it. We all think, what would happen if I spread this rumor around the water cooler today? What would happen, what would people think if I wore this today? What might happen if I try to run this yellow light? And all the time we're trying to figure out what impulses are appearing to us that would be a really bad idea. Because 99% of the things that occur to you are, you're constantly saying, nah, I don't think I'll do that today. Women have no idea how often males do that. Say, no, I don't think I'd better do that now. My wife says, I don't even want to know what's going on inside there. As long as you behave well, you're welcome. Well, those religions that think there is, that thinking is, those religions that believe that thinking is the same thing as doing there are no males in heaven. But in any event, back to the prefrontal lobes. These are the nubs that let us peer into the future. Metaphorically speaking, they are the lamps on the brow. This is a biblical phrase that referred to Moses. It was said that he had lamps on his brow. And during the Middle Ages, people didn't know what to make of that. They thought it must have been a mistranslation, so they found a word that was similar sounding to lamps. It was horns. And so all through the Middle Ages, Moses was depicted with horns on his head. And by extrapolation, all Jews had horns on their heads. But in fact, it was lamps. These are what we use to try to peer into the future, to try to imagine what's going on in the undiscovered country just ahead. Now, we know this because people who have had prefrontal lobotomies, pardon me, who've had these lobes snipped, lose interest in the future. They no longer do the Gedanken experiment. They may remain perfectly intelligent and skilled, but they no longer think about tomorrow, which is why I'd rather have a free bottle in front of me than a prefrontal lobotomy. You're supposed to start a talk with a joke, warm them up. But after that great introduction by Daniel, I figured I didn't really need to waste any of my jokes on you guys. Now, so all of these audiences share this wish to peer into the future. And it's not just trying to find errors to avoid. How many of you have seen me recently on the History Channel on Life After People? It was the most popular show ever on the History Channel, and they started a show, an ongoing series showing cities falling apart. I got the miniseries. I don't understand how they're going to go 100 more episodes. Now we'll watch this city fall apart. But there's a certain Schadenfreude pleasure in that show about looking into tomorrow and saying, ah, the earth will continue, even after the canker sore on its lip, humanity, has vanished. My science fiction has a tendency to be a little more hopeful than that. So I don't think it's gonna be that easy for the earth to get rid of us. And one of the reasons why is because we're very good at problem solving. And that brings us to today's topic, which is third millennium problem solving, tackling accelerating change through tools of visualization, collaboration, and citizen empowerment. As you can see from the date, I've gave this talk before. Not many times, though. This was a talk I gave at Google. My putative fifth cousin, Sergey, up there, had me up there to give a talk, and then he had me spit into a jar. Well, his wife runs a DNA testing company. He wanted to see whether my children were his heirs. At least that's what I hoped he was after. All I got out of it was a card good for 100 free Google searches. Anyway, let's talk about this, because accelerating change is what a lot of us are intrigued by. I'm sure some of you are in the Bay Area and you know the Extropians, the Ray Kurzweil types, the ones who believe that we're about to enter what's called the singularity. And within 30 years, they confidently predict that we'll all become gods. Now, this is transcendentalism gone amok. And if you like, during questions, I'll address these friends of mine. They are the mad ghosts in the room, but they are entertaining. And we can talk about that. But they talk about accelerating change, how this singularity that we're heading towards is going to happen because change is not only a fact of our lives, but it is accelerating faster and faster. And if it's good change, if it adds up to good change with a lot of problems along the way, if we solve problems along the way at an accelerating rate, then we might hit this singularity that they're talking about. But the only solution, the only way you can solve enough problems so that you can evade the mines and the pitfalls and the quicksand on our way to this bright tomorrow is if you discover the problems in front of you before you tumble into the pits. And one of the ways you do that is by actually looking the other direction, into history, seeing how our ancestors made the mistakes that they made that kept human progress so slow until recently. And especially looking into history to see what started everything accelerating. Now, what you see here is a very rough chart of human progress at visualization, memory, and attention. Three things that seem to go progress together in time. What you have is a beginning down in the bottom around in the 1500s of the discovery of the printing press and lenses, glass lenses, which empowered us to amplify the human power of sight. It had always been the same, and the older, more powerful people in civilization had less eyesight than the younger, enthusiastic ones. The printing press expanded, extrapolated, exponentiated our power to know things. At the time, people were concerned that expanding the amount that that human beings know, or expanding the amount that they see, would drive them crazy. We now look at the notion of having a few dozen books and a telescope and a microscope as being rather quaint and unthreatening. It's not a very large expansion of our ability to see and to know, and yet it made all the difference in propelling the Renaissance into the beginnings of the age of industry. Just the glass lenses enabling us to see microbes propelled the germ theory of disease. That plus the printing press enabling us to share the knowledge. Unsung in there is the discovery of perspective, which occurred over a couple of centuries leading up to this point. But this changed our whole notion of attention, how people focus in on what they see. As a matter of fact, the great sailing voyages of discovery, gunpowder, conquests in the Western world, all around the world, none of these things got Europeans thinking that they had surpassed the Romans. They still hearkened back to the Romans as fonts of wisdom and law. Until perspective, when suddenly people said, well, the greatest accomplishments of the Greeks and the Romans were in art. And we now know something about art that they didn't know. And for the first time, intellectuals in Europe said, huh, maybe there's such a thing as progress. And you can see, moving up the chart, you can see how one piece of progress fed into another. And there were continually changes in our ability to see, our ability to know, and our ability to perceive. Printing augmented memory, glass lenses augmented vision, perspective augmented attention. And each time this happened, it led to a crisis. The first use of printing presses was not to elevate the human mind and to improve discourse. It was to create doctrinaire religious tracts that created one of the most vicious and long-lasting wars in the history of the European continent. And each time there's a quandary, Renaissance versus rigid doctrine, and a key concept, the notion of progress and the value of each individual. when the individual can see more and know more and attend to more, you have a situation in which it's hard to fit the individual in as just an unimportant passing thing. The real world became significant. The great sages of history, Buddha, Socrates, Plato, Jesus, they all tended to say the same thing. The real world is rough, gritty, and your senses are poor. You can never know what any object really is. You can never know what it is. Your senses are poor. You're fooling yourself all the time. Our great talent is self-deception. A talent, by the way, that I make use of when you hire me to entertain you with one of my novels. You use your fantastically trained skill at scanning black squiggles on a page, decrypting an incantation that I had put on the page. And as your eyes scan across the page, you decrypt it into star-spanning explosions. Deep human insights. Cosmic revelations. Much, much better art form than that pallid celluloid craft in Hollywood. In any event, you are trained technicians at this art of decrypting a code that lets you fool yourself into temporarily believing in other worlds, in other possibilities. So when I say that human beings' greatest talent is delusion and being great liars, it does not necessarily mean I mean it in a pejorative sense. What we need desperately is the ability to tell when we're lying to ourselves. Wouldn't that calm politics down considerably? So, you can see how, as we passed through the 18th century, memory was expanded by mass literacy. Vision was expanded by printed illustrations, where you got to perceive an illustration of an event that happened across the oceans. Science and democracy expanded our ability to perceive things with the notion that we could change them through the use of the ballot box, for example, or through the use of science discovering alternatives to the pain we see around us. In the 19th century, mass education, photography, and cinema, these expanded what we could know and see even more. Then we got computing, databases, television, mass media, abstraction. And now we're heading into the era that goes far beyond the internet, into what's sometimes called the knowledge mesh, or omnivalence, the ability to see anything anywhere. And as I point out in The Transparent Society, the choice is not whether or not cameras will pervade our world. It's been called Brin's corollary on Moore's law, that the cameras get cheaper, smaller, more numerous, faster, more mobile every year. You are not going to outlaw the cameras. In a few years, kids who buy these rolls of stickers that they irritatingly stick on walls all over the place, they're going to buy rolls of penny cameras. As soon as you unstick it from the roll, it's active. It has a year-long battery and its own registration address on IPv6 cyberspace. Stuck to lampposts, stuck to any surface, virtually invisible, what are you going to do? In the privacy debates that I'm engaged in, I say, what is your plan? How are you going to outlaw this? You're not going to succeed. Find for me one human civilization in which the people ever restricted the amount that the elites could see. We're monkeys. We believe that the amount that we can know and see is intrinsically correlated with our power and our ability to control what goes on around us. If you're an elite, you'll do whatever it takes to know as much as you can. And if it's against the law, you'll do it cryptically. As the great author Robert Heinlein said, the chief thing achieved by privacy laws is to make the bugs smaller. If you honestly think that you can limit with well-meaning laws what the mighty will know about you, here is an exercise. We have the world's greatest zoo right here. Go to the zoo tomorrow and pick up a stick and sharpen it so that you have a pointed stick. Climb into the baboon enclosure and poke out the eyes of the largest baboon. Here's a hint. He won't let you. And notice I chose somebody who could defend himself. The large baboons will not let you blind them, but they will reluctantly allow you to look at them. If nobody is blind, if the cameras are everywhere, if we embrace them, then we may be visible to the mighty, but they will be visible to us. And that is our only chance. And that's the point I raise in The Transparent Society. Those who haven't read it think I am against privacy. There's an entire chapter in there about how I like privacy. Privacy is important. We wouldn't be human without it. And if we are sovereign and free and mighty and empowered citizens, we'll vote ourselves some privacy. It will be smaller than what we grew up with. But we'll be able to protect our homes from the peeping Toms. We'll be able to keep a curtilage of intimacy because we'll be able to catch the peeping Toms ourselves. I got in a lot of debate with my friends at the ACLU after the Patriot Act. It wasn't over whether it was a loathsome piece of legislation, which it was. After the 9/11 attacks, I got a lot of email messages that simply read P206. And it took me a little while. And then I realized it was the Transparent Society. I turned to page 206. And there's a paragraph in there that begins, well, suppose terrorists ever do bring down both World Trade Center towers. What will the Attorney General ask for? And I went on to describe a mild and reasonable version of the Patriot Act. And the ratcheting effect that happens every time civilization takes a hit. Our paid protector caste will say we need to see better. And they may be telling the truth. Your dog, your watchdog, may need to see better. The ACLU worries if they see better, our freedom will be destroyed. Therefore, they draw lines in the sand on arcane rules about search warrants. And the next time we take a hit from terrorism, we get knocked back, but there's a new line in the sand, and they try to defend that. To me, the loathsome parts of the Patriot Act are not those parts that let our government protectors see better. That's going to happen anyway. And they have an arguable reason to see better. The parts of the Patriot Act that terrify me are the parts that allow the government to see better in secret, without us looking back. Having a skilled watchdog is not bad. Having a skilled watchdog without a choke chain to remind it it's a dog and not a wolf, that's bad. But I got off a little bit on the Transparent Society because it's highly involved in whether or not omnivalence takes us down the wrong road. We're heading into a future when you will be walking down the street with your sunglasses or your glasses, and on the little corner of your glasses will be a camera, virtually invisible. And it will scan everything around you for you, recording it, keeping track, making alerts. Sensors will detect if there's suspicious, if there's something suspicious in that puddle, and put a little color overlay on that puddle so you won't step in it. Naturally, there will be the arrows taking you to where you want to go. Depending on how you tune your... Oh, by the way, you can find a short story that depicts all of this at davidbrin.com. For free. On the inside of your glasses, or even as Werner Vinge portrays, in the inside of your contact lenses, will be painted overlays on the mixed reality, mixture of virtual and real. You might click to a level of IPv6 cyberspace where all the buildings are covered with vines and dinosaurs are picking their heads over. Werner portrays this in his novel. Or where only members of your affinity groups who've been passing nearby, you might scrawl a little post-it note, stick it there, and only members of your affinity groups will ever see that post-it note hanging in the air. Or if you click to another level, you can't even see for all the post-it notes. And most importantly, as people are walking by, their faces will be scanned, looked up on facial registries, and they'll all have name tags. You'll never be at a loss for who that person is. It'll even, if you code it that way, it'll even say how many times you've met them before, or if you've ever met them before, or the first two sentences of their public profile, bragging public profile, or should you decide to recode, the first two sentences of the rebuttal by their ex-spouse. The point is that what are you talking about here? What you're talking about is a vast expansion of vision and memory. You will have access to, as if out of your brain's memory, knowledge about the people you meet. You'll see them almost like gods, because you'll be able to tooth-click or mumble to your subvocal and actually see the hometown they came from. Now, this is a vast expansion of memory and knowledge, and yet it's going to take us full circle back to the village where our ancestors all lived. Your brain can know anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 people, depending on how skilled you are at knowing names and faces. That's the rough range that a gregarious human would have had to know in the days when we were evolving. When you might have been the gregarious one sent with the cart, with the produce of your farming hamlet to the big town to make the deals, to pick up the tools. And the deals were made on a handshake basis. Why? Because the shopkeeper and you absolutely depended on your reputations. How many of you love Shakespeare? You can see how in almost every play there's a duel to the death over reputation, because your reputation was like life to you. Today, your reputation is carried around with you in prosthetics. Your credit rating, your credit cards, your driver's license. None of this will be necessary when the village returns. When you go to some small town in Thailand and you enter a curio shop and you see some cool walking sticks, and some of them can even run, and you say, you click in your sister from her shop in Duluth, and you say, would you like some of these? And the shopkeeper clicks in and gets in the three-way with your sister, sees her credit rating, sees everything about her address and everything and what she might need, talks about the style, I can have them for you in 3 weeks. You shake his hand. It's witnessed by all parties, and you walk away. The village is coming back. The village is coming back. And if you have any sense at all, you're going to be scared of that. Because 90% of the villages were tyrannized by the local lord, terrified of the local thugs, and horrified by the local gossip. The three great banes of existence in the old villages, except, well, there was also death and starvation. How can you ensure that when this village returns, we're going to stay free, that we won't be bullied by new lords, that we won't be bullied by new thugs, that we won't be oppressed by new gossips? Certainly our children are laying it all out on Facebook. And they are betting, they are wagering, they are committing themselves to living in a free and tolerant future civilization. Because otherwise, they're screwed. Just like I absolutely depend on such a civilization, because any other human civilization would burn me at the stake. And I think there are a few of you out there who are likewise flammable. As a matter of fact, I sometimes end my talks by saying, stay flammable. Because only thus do you feel a sense of commitment every day to defend this particular renaissance. Because there is an alternative to the bad village, and that is the good village. How many of you ever saw Andy Hardy movies with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland? You know everything about everybody else in town, but it's not used for oppression. You hear that this one family, the dad lost his job and is sick. Hey, let's put on a show. It could happen. It could happen. Americans have believed that things could happen. It's the secret of the positive sum game. One of the most important books of the last 20 years was Robert Wright's book, Non-Zero. Do you know what a zero-sum game is? All of you do, of course. A zero-sum game is a game in which I get a point, it means you lost a point. I win by you losing. A positive-sum game is where we play the game. I try to win, but I win by everybody winning. A lot of today's internet billionaires are fundamentally different than the billionaires behind Fox News. In that they believe in a positive-sum game. My cousin Sergey, for example, Jeff Bezos, a lot of these guys, they believe that they want to be the richest and most successful of a civilization in which everybody's getting rich very fast. That's a positive-sum game. There are people who actually believe in negative-sum games, and allow me to take a little more of your time, because there aren't any talks after this, by illustrating how you can test for the personality of zero positive or negative sum game. Ask your friend or your neighbor what they would do, what they would wish for if they knew that their worst enemy would get twice as much. See, there are some clever zero sum and positive ends. Answers to this. One is the positive sum person doesn't care, doesn't let that affect what they wish for. Zero sum can be clever, like I'd wish for all the women I could possibly handle. And that's what I got. The negative sum answer is, I'd wish to be blind in one eye. We are a species of diversity, and it is very important that we bear that in mind. Okay, let's move along. Now, most of these media revolutions pushed the notion of broadcast, the printing press, for example, went from the few to the many. Sound recording did the same thing, films, radio, TV. The people were passive, though sometimes mentally active, recipients. Telegraph and telephone were different. They empowered conversation. And Clay Shirky recently commented on this by saying that the internet merged these realms, unleashing speed and variety of connections, empowering all to be producers. Now, each new technological wave that I was describing to you offered godlike expansions of vision, knowledge, attention, and reach. However, they also brought about fear of hubris, of human beings arrogating too much. After all, what is one of the most vivid and interesting parts of the book of Genesis? It's the story of the Tower of Babel, in which God and the angels are concerned because they speak of humankind and they say, if they continue down this road, nothing will be denied them, nothing will be beyond them. It says very clearly, nothing is beyond us. And instead of that being punishable by fire from heaven or a flood, instead it was stymied by making the puzzle harder, by splitting us up into all of our language groups. A problem that we are now completely and decisively overcoming. So metaphorically speaking, we are rising up after 4,000 years to the same challenge as the Tower of Babel. Now, is this hubris that is to be punished? I don't consider the story of the Tower of Babel to be punishment. I consider it to be delay. I consider it making the game harder. And at any point, it could become harder for us again. But I don't consider hubris to be a crime. But you have to understand, in all of these previous revolutions of vision, memory, and attention, many people said it was hubris. Many people said it would lead to destruction. There were calls for renunciation or control by a trusted elite, most extremely held by Ted Kaczynski, but Bill Joy's notion, the future doesn't need us, also expresses this notion. He concedes that perhaps the new artificial intelligences that we create will not stomp us flat like simple-minded Matrix, Terminator, morons, cyber morons, but in fact may go on to their own interests and even pat us on the head and even turn the earth into a garden for us. And he loathes the notion of no longer being in charge. Well, you know, I think he has a point. Go to davidbryn.com and download my story, Stones of Significance. It's one of the few short stories that are set after a singularity, where you'll see my suggestion, brash suggestion, to the artificial intelligences that they may need us for an unusual reason. What talent do we have? And it's even the least of us that has this talent. Not just you cyber, super brainy nerds, but Joe Blow on the street, even Joe the plumber. They all have this talent, and they have a billion years of history behind this talent. It's the one thing we're all good at, and the machines are lousy at. Wanting. We're all really, really good at wanting, and the machines aren't. What if, when they are super smart and they can solve all problems, they decide to connect with us, to join with us, and leave us in charge of the wanting part? I have found that even the people who are most worried about this whole AI thing find that that is something that they could live with. The point is that we have these calls for renunciation every single time one of these breakthroughs happens. Every time human beings can't cope with all this new knowledge, access to knowledge. Human beings can't cope with the speed. Human beings can't cope with the expansion of vision. We should either renounce it or go with the trusted elite. My new novel that I'm working on is called Existence. And it is about, among other things, all the ways in which we could lose our existence. And the elites of society, or a fraction of the elites of society, have rationalized that they need to step in and reinstitute the classic human social structure for our own sake. Because otherwise, the masses of the people will have access to all these tools and destruction will ensue. It might even be true someday, but it's a rationalization. We have never so far refused these new tools, these new prostheses, these new prosthetics. Always people adapt to the godlike powers and become accustomed to them, expanding a creative commerce, education, and citizenship. So, there is the depiction of Moses, probably one of the greatest sculptures ever made by Michelangelo. It's in a small church in Rome. If you go to Rome, go on a pilgrimage and see this. And this slide talks about the Gedanken experiment and the prefrontal lobes, how to spot the mistakes to avoid. At worst, we weave satisfying delusions. And this is, of course, what we do with our politics. Unless you have the habit of being a contrarian, I recommend it highly. All my libertarian friends think I'm a flaming socialist, and all my socialist friends think I'm an Ayn Rand follower. I told you I'd have been burned at the stake in any other culture. As a matter of fact, this is the only one of my reincarnations in which I got old enough to even have kids, let alone get gray hair. Needless to say, I'm deeply loyal to this Renaissance. Now, efforts to systematically improve anticipation include data mining, data sifting, pre-analysis, visualization, advanced analytics. We exploit diversity through prediction markets and polling. Prediction registries are things I've been pushing for a long time, but the honeypot concept of prediction markets is not letting it get very much attention. Enlightenment accountability arenas. These were the great innovations of the Enlightenment in response to all of these trends that I was talking about. Markets, democracy, science, and justice courts. These all have aspects in common that are masked by the fact that their products are different, and so their processes are different. And yet, markets, science, democracy, law courts all harness human competitiveness while in setting up complex rules to ensure that the result is not destruction of the competitors. Excuse me, I'm losing track of time. I need to keep track of the time. Oh. Well, I know you'll be forgiving. The point is that when I go back to talk to the CIA and our professional anticipators, I find a deep problem. And that is that they are obsessed with spending our tax money trying to anticipate every conceivable threat. And they can't. 9/11 proved they can't. Katrina proved they can't. They can anticipate a lot of them. They can get better and better and better at anticipating. And still you get things like the toxic assets phenomenon, which some predicted, some anticipated, but our civilization did not. What you have is flows of information. We have the formal and hierarchical institutions that all advanced civilizations had. But then we have those four arena markets, markets, democracy, science, and courts, in which there's systematic competition. And then you have the people, which are chaotic, stochastic, constantly interacting in strange and impulsive ways. And yet the fundamental source of resiliency, creativity, accountability, and sovereignty. And this is the source of the other thing. The way we deal with the future is not only trying to use the prefrontal lobes to anticipate, but there's a second thing we humans do well when dealing with the future, and that is resilience. We roll with the punches. We roll and get up. Elaine Scarry of the Boston Globe and I were the only people who pointed out after 9/11 probably the most important salient fact of that day. And that is the fact that every useful act that was taken that day was performed by amateurs. Not a single action of the paid professional protector caste, from the military to CIA to the firefighters who rushed into that building and died, leaving New Yorkers to put out the fire. Not one professional action was effective that day. But the people were. They took all the video footage. They used tools that dour curmudgeons are claiming are enslaving us and called into the buildings and said, I don't care what the 911 operator is telling you to stay by your desk. Get out, saving 38,000 lives. And talk about cell phones, the rebellion of the heroes on flight UA-93. Resilience is as important as anticipation. There's a little advertising here. Why is the core Enlightenment innovation counterintuitive? Most infome age dilemmas are solved by more light, not less. And that is the key notion behind not only anticipation, but also enhancing resilience. Now, I'm going to show you a slide here that's from one of the scenario studies that I do for the government now and then. One of the reasons you haven't seen a Brin novel for a while. Sorry. And this one, they asked us to come up with a scenario each for how enemies might try to harm us through terrorism. And I refused. I said, I can come up with a dozen different types of enemies, and then at least three scenarios each for each of these types of enemies, just to show you how silly it is not to try to come up with these scenarios. By all means, workshop them all with anticipation. But to think that coming up with some scenarios and then spending $1 billion on each scenario is going to make us safe. This is just one of many slides. And this one dealt with super empowered, angry young men, the fashionable enemy of today. Whereas it was rival states before the fall of the Soviet Union, I have theories about what the next one will be. But the point is that all prior civilizations vested all power to protect in a central authority, and all failed. See, across the 20th century, there was one monotonic trend. That monotonic trend was the professionalization of everything. Fascism came and went. We were promised at the beginning of the 20th century a science of the mind, and we're still waiting. Things, fashions came and went. Even science came in fits and starts. But almost all the things that a mom and dad did for their family back in 1900 wound up being farmed out either through the market or through government by the end of the century, except for the basics of reproduction and even large parts of that. The professionalization of everything was a monotonic trend. And it has momentum, and we see it in our military, in our professional services. And it's drawing to a close. It has to. The doubling rate of professionals on this planet, certainly in this country, cannot continue. You'll run out of people, let alone people who can become professionals. We have gotten rid of some of the grotesque injustices that kept half the population that was female from entering these professions. Half the, quarter of the population to a third of the population that were minorities didn't allow them in. Well, we've gotten rid of these illogical injustices. Thank God, let's be proud of ourselves. But the reason it wasn't necessarily goody two-shoes. Most ethics can be grounded perfectly well in pragmatism. The stupidity of banishing a large part of your brain pool. But the point is that the professionalization of everything cannot continue. Demographics reasons. And plus the fact that we are proving so much smarter than we thought we were. 30 years ago at Caltech, before the internet age, I remember the discussions, worried discussions among the undergraduates about the specialization effect. We were all terrified of the fact that every year you had to know more and more about less and less in order to graduate from grad school, later and later in order to be able to know anything at all. And then this narrow cylinder of knowledge would be cut off by vocabulary, by knowledge, by interaction from other places where people would be duplicating your work. We were terrified of it. And now nobody speaks of it at all. It was the fixation of our generation, and nobody even remembers that we were afraid of it. Today, what are we afraid of? I'm going to go ahead here. What are we afraid of? Delete. We're afraid, is Google making us stupid? We're afraid that what's happening is that we're spreading our attention so wide that we're becoming shallow-minded. Not all of us are afraid of this. Clay Shirky and the boosters and all that, they're pointing at what's going on in Iran and saying, see? Who needs to express anything in more than 140 characters? Well, the stupid is there and it's growing, and I'll get to that. But the point is that all we are not only escape the specialization trap because of Google, we escape because we became even smarter than we thought we'd be, as in all those previous revolutions. And what's happening is you can be a skilled professional at one thing and have surplus time and mental energy to have a skilled avocation in something else. And that is the answer to the wall of professionalization. The spread of avocations through civilization will mean that if all of our first responders die in a crisis, there will be enough amateurs to step in. And I urge you all to look up CERT, the Community Emergency Response Team. It's where the green hats are. Are there any other fellow CERT members out here? Right arm, farm out. You take 20 hours of training from your local fire department and you get a nifty green crash helmet and backpack full of goodies and a green vest and the right to boss your neighbors around in an emergency. It's all that's left of civil defense in this country, but it's way cool. And during the San Diego fires 2 years ago, I manned a sheriff's checkpoint to let the sheriff go off to more important stuff. Got my neighborhood organized. The point is that we'll only be able to handle this age and provide the resilience that we'll need when some horrible crisis hits if we embrace the tools of resilience, the number one of which is citizenship. And I've talked about this endlessly at a lot of different talks about how the internet, the cell system, how they seem to be almost designed to prevent citizen resilience. For example, in Katrina, there were 150,000 people with charged, active, sophisticated radios in their pocket that they could not use. Right now in Iran, they are reduced to Twitter, and the Iranian government is probably going to cut that off. Because the cell phones have been disconnected at intervals, because a cell system is inherently centralized. And I suggested all you need to do is to have a secondary backup for texting messages peer-to-peer until the messages reach the edge of the afflicted area and somebody's cell phone can get into the network. A secondary peer-to-peer text passing system could be done with packet switching, and almost anybody in this room could design it. And it doesn't even have to hurt the cell phone companies. They could charge for it. If you couldn't come up with a system that would charge for peer-to-peer passed messages and report in, then you don't deserve to be in this room. This is an example of the kinds of ideas that we need to be developing in order to boost the resiliency of a civilization that desperately depends upon both anticipation and resiliency. I won't go into everything on this slide. Had any of you seen the issue of Salon magazine in which I got my worst hate mail? Even dissing Star Wars didn't get me more hate mail than this. And that was this one called Why Johnny Can't Code. It was about something that I suddenly noticed, and that's my job, you see. My job is to notice stuff. I'm paid to be interesting. I'm not paid to be right. Lots of you are paid to be right. I'm just paid to be interesting and to knock things around a little. I noticed one day when my son brought home his math textbook that there was at the end of every chapter there was a review questions, review section, the problem set, and then try it in basic. A little section where 12, 15, 20 lines of code, and it would do a little experiment that would iterate or something that would demonstrate what the chapter was about, the concept in math. And I asked his teacher, when was the last time anybody did any of those? And he said, 15 years. Now, I realized one day that there was no way to get BASIC on our computers. There was no way to do these codes. Yes, there were ways. Listen, I've heard it all, okay? Y BASIC, Q BASIC, go download this and download that, read the instruction, and nobody paying any attention to the simple fact that if you add a step, one step, between going to the site and plugging in the actual codes and pressing return. If you add one step, you lose 50%. And I'm given all these 30, 40, 50, 80 step processes to get BASIC going on the computer. And I said, has anybody noticed that programming languages, and especially a lingua franca common programming language that's common enough that it could go into textbooks and reliably turnkey simply ask all the kids in America to just try this, simply vanished. My son wanted to try some of these things. We couldn't do it. Do you know how we did it? We went on eBay, and for $50, in its original boxes with original manuals, we bought a Commodore 64. And it worked right out of the box. I said this whole shtick to three different executives at Microsoft on three different occasions, and they answered with almost verbatim the same answer. Sorry back there. The answer was, there are still basic programs in math textbooks? Don't worry, they'll go away. And in response to this article, a guy in Denmark came up with Quite Basic. You go to the quitebasic.com website, and there in front of you is an entry screen and a performance screen, and all you do is write the code, press return, and the results appear right next to it. You're welcome. The question of, and don't tell me how awful BASIC is. That's not the issue. The issue is having something in common that any kid could use and then become unhappy with and move on. Okay, now I've spoken of the singularity. Werner Vinge's novel illustrates some of the transparent society things about the village that we're heading towards. And then you see the curmudgeons down below. Michael Crichton, for example. I model a character in my new novel after him. The people who believe that anything that science can come up with can be a morality tale against hubris. The point is that we're entering in an era in which we need tools of discourse to be able to solve problems. And one of the additional things that I've noticed is a digital divide between the asynchronous realm and the synchronous realm. The asynchronous realm is the realm of adults, where you do web browsing, you email, you share files, you download, you search, you research, you collaborate, you do your blog. Now, yes, there are teeny boppers and immature people doing all of those things, but at least these things are useful to adults. The synchronous realm consists of chat and instant messaging and Twitter and interactive gaming and virtual worlds, and I could probably scale how productive you are as an adult in the world by whether or not you raise your hand when I say, do any of you do any of that crap? Much. Well, all right, do you get money by providing that crap to teeny boppers? All right, well, there you go, you see. That's a reason for adults to do it as a business, to provide this synchronous realm to people who actually want to waste lifespan. And our children think they have an infinite supply. They always have. In your upper left, you have chat. Now, who does chat anymore? Well, the thing is, it's done a lot. In 1971, I sat at a teletype long before the first computer monitor was ever invented, at Caltech on one of the very first experimental networks. And I typed in a very primitive early form of messaging system, and the teletype went and said DB colon, and part of what I wrote. The next line was CK colon, and part of what somebody else was writing somewhere else on campus. Then LR colon, part of what they were saying, and then DB finished my sentence. Now, why is that familiar to you? I should be describing something that should make almost anybody not my age go, ugh, Stone Age, instead of something I just did last week on Second Life. MySpace and Facebook, millions of teens. Look, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn, and I have actually used them to accomplish leveraging of my own life twice in 4 years. But I have to keep them up. I have to answer every friend request. I have the lamprey on my jugular. This one just speaks for itself. Can I move on? All right. The point is, and I need to take a vote here. By the way, if you have to go to the bathroom, simply go. I've decided that since there's nothing after this, I've decided I'm going to give you one of my Castro speeches. It's how I got my wife. All right, so I'm not going to consider myself heavily worried about the fact that we've passed the first hour. I didn't mean it that way, that we've passed the official deadline. I will not. I don't have the stamina I used to have, so I promise. We're talking about discourse and conversation. Now, one of the patented techniques I use is to step back. Look at the grand historical or even prehistorical context in which things are. I've done this many times during this talk. Our skills of conversation go back considerably before all these revolutions I was talking about, the printing press, glass lenses. Can anybody read this right here? It says, when are you going to stop wasting your time with that science fiction nonsense and start dealing with reality? And he's drawing a science fiction story of a cart and a horse. One of the ways in which we have dealt with the attention economy is by allocating our attention to different people at different times. You adjust your distance from people. You turn away from others. You heed reputation. You favor what's interesting. You remember what's important. You have rules, obey rules of courtesy. You keep a train of thought while staying alert for surprise. We still do all of these things. Even at a cocktail party, you keep track of the gist of the conversation. If you're in a conversation with someone who you consider to be important or the topic is important, you remember more. You take note of more. High priority attention goes to people you face. And yet, if someone three conversations behind you mentions your name, have you ever noticed? It leaps out from the buzz of conversation going on behind you. And very tellingly, often three or four words, even a whole sentence that preceded your name. How many of you have ever had that happen? How many of you have not? The point is that this makes very clear that your brain is very active. It's very busy. It is culling and collating and listening to all that buzz. Or else, how would it not only pull out your name, but the words that preceded it? Your brain is providing you with services that allow you to focus your attention while remaining sensitive to alerts. Now, the very interesting thing is, why have almost none of these services been replicated online? Now, I can prove that they have not been. A wish list of services that would boost online discourse. For example, I mentioned you orient toward or away from people, you go closer to or away from people. Time has effects on how much attention you pay to something, the reputation of others, and the topic, whether it's important to you or not. Now, suppose a system online of conversation were to affect the size of speech, depending upon any of these traits. The rendering of avatars, the rendering of the video, compression of the point of view. Gisting is a word that I coined for being able to compress the gist of what the other person's saying. When I presented this at Google, it was the only thing they were interested in. Because, of course, it's up their ballywick. Lots of different semantic services that are related to this business of hearing your name three conversations away. That arrow has never made it online, and I can prove it because I patented that arrow. The United States government granted me a patent on taking all those traits of conversation on the left and turning them into these services online. Now, the list of objections that I have seen smart alecks give at various gatherings for You can't patent that. Patenting is evil. Patent doesn't prove that anything has never been done before. Yes, that's true. And just because the federal government, and by the way, they did find some minor pieces of prior art that I had to adjust the patent to. 10 years I have been presenting this slide and ones like it, asking anybody to come up with the prior art, including 2,000 people at the Computer Human Interface Conference in Minneapolis a few years ago. The number of smart alecks who would stand up and say, of course it's been done before, overlaps 100% with the number of smart alecks who never got in touch with me again when I demanded that they find the prior art. It is possible, and I'm demonstrating this not to brag about my patent, but to illustrate how we are often transfixed by honeypots. Honeypot concepts that draw everybody. It's only natural that avatars and quick twits, I'm sorry, tweets, should attract a lot of investment and attention. They are obvious. But why must they attract all of the investment and attention? Every time I go back to give a keynote at the Media Lab, and they love me, I chide them about this, and I say, and I ask the graduate students what they're all doing, and it's all the emotional web and graphical representations of interpersonal relationships and representations of impulse and nothing about talking to people in ways that get stuff done. I was back there at IBM just 6 months ago, and their notion of collaborationware, I was all excited. They're doing collaborationware to try to get units and subunits of a company to be able to visualize the project and to be able to share information with other sections in the company, and the goals are all wonderful. And when I saw what they had, well, you ride this magic surfboard over to this portion of the company, and there's a kiosk in which you can hold bubble conversations with the other people synchronously. The question is, are we heading in a direction where everything's impulse, everything's about style? The fact of the matter is, the great science fiction author, Theodore Sturgeon, you know, when he was told by smarmy, you know, campus literarchy types that 90% of science fiction is crap. He said 90% of anything is crap. Well, is 90% accurate now on the internet? If you expand the total amount of stuff, which those revolutions that I was talking about at the beginning, I'm being extraordinarily disciplined in this talk. I'm actually staying on top. All those revolutions expand the amount of stuff that we can pay attention to, that we can know, that we can see, and that we can pay attention to. And the prosthetics help us to do that. And it's marvelous. It's godlike. It's helping us rebuild the Tower of Babel. And I don't think that that is sacrilegious, or it oughtn't to be. But the fact of the matter is, if you expand the amount of shit, it's going to be harder to find the pearls. Shiva is there because the dance of Shiva is creative. Markets, democracy, science, they're not just about encouraging expression. Expression only to a limited degree enhances democracy. There has to be destruction. Bad ideas have to die in order to make room for good new ones. I'm not talking tyranny here. When have you ever seen an argument online settle anything for once and for all? You can see on the blog commentary thing the most cogent refutation of a previous statement in which the guy was repeating some awful truism, and the new person devastates it, eviscerates it, disproves it. Is that going to prevent, is that going to reduce by a scintilla its likelihood to reappear? We will not get anywhere at this rate unless getting smarter includes improving our ability to collaborate, to interact, to reciprocally criticize and have the criticism stick. Because when Shiva destroys, it's the original scientist. You create your beautiful theory and you present it to the scientific community, and like Shiva, they dance upon it and trample it. And if Shiva bounces off and says, huh, it's still standing, then you go, I'm the king for now. Until Shiva returns, until we know enough for it to be destroyed. But when Shiva bounces off, something new and better will rise up. That's discourse. So, believe it or not, I actually am nearing the end. Technological advances in vision, memory, attention disrupt civilization, provoking crises of confidence. Civilization has passed every test, although with some real crises, like the 30 Years' War caused by printing. The Junkers, lordly class, aristocratic class of Germany, thought that they could use Hitler against the communists and control him and get rid of him whenever they wanted because they controlled the newspapers. Not realizing that he was a master of a new method of communication, radio and loudspeakers, which people weren't used to yet. So the demagogues of those days, unlike poor Rush, had real resonance and power with the amplification of their voices. Unfortunately, in this country, our master of radio communication had limited power ambitions. His name was FDR. The point is that each time there's a crisis of confidence, we're seeing it played out in Iran right now. And Iran was a testbed earlier, where cassette tapes were smuggled into Iran during the era of the Shah, duplicated in homes, and sent around to all the mosques, where that medium of communication rallied the supporters of the religious revolution. And now we're hoping that Twitter can accomplish the same thing in 140 characters or less. Civilization narrowly passed every test by empowering people to apply reciprocal accountability and with new tools of problem solving. But 21st century problem solving requires, and you're seeing a very shortened version of this talk, I removed all the parts about art, for example. Art shakes assumptions and shakes the status quo. The tools that we need for better art are visualization, simulation, games, and more openness, and that's happening. Anticipation. Leaders try to anticipate and foresee dangers and opportunities. The new tools are analytics, modeling and correlation, data gathering, accountability. We're seeing that happening. Resilience is another way of dealing with problems in the future. Citizens are robust. They respond well to surprise. 20th century tools that they'll need is agile communication, self-organization skills, dispersed expertise, transparency, the ability to achieve actual refutation, and confidence. Discourse needs analytical tools that spread and are available to everybody, better dispute resolution, better interface. These are desperately needed. And now you see why I talked about all of this to you. Because you folks are part of an industry that is needed, not just to supply what's market-driven, but to explore what we need before we realize that we need it. At the very least, in your beer sessions, your one beer, your two beer, your three beer sessions, when you're not working on the problem that's right in front of you, you should be thinking, what do we need? And how could I make some money supplying it? So, that brings us to the end of a long journey. I'm going to show you here a little concept, that Sheldon Brown here at UCSD, a brilliant tech artist, and I worked on what's called the Exorarium. It's the extraterrestrial terrarium. When he heard about this, Will Wright invited us up to talk to him because he was 2 years late delivering Spore. That was 2 years ago. He finally delivered Spore, but he was worried because he was behind schedule. And we laughed and we said, maybe if we had four orders of magnitude more funding, we might be a threat to you, Will. But we pointed out to him, how many of you have played Spore? Where you take a budget and you buy traits for your different creatures. We pointed out to him that what he was doing was not evolution. What he was doing was intelligent design. He mused for a second whether or not to be offended and then laughed. What we do is evolution. But with that little aside, I'm going to end it here. I hope I've managed to do my job, which is to rattle assumptions. If I don't do that, I'll probably have to go back to working for a living. Anyway, thank you all, and I'll hang around for questions. Thanks a lot. Anybody need to rush off to the can or to do something more important, or who would like to ask questions? Yeah.
Okay. So let me quibble, because you know it's easier to do that.
Anything but basic. Do not.
So I couldn't find one. I couldn't find one on eBay for less than $79. So you may have raised the price.
This was 3 years ago.
Okay. So you ask when any online argument has ever been settled and when the refutation of the wrong information has ever prevented the spread of the wrong information even a little.
I
can count zillions of times when I've been personally informed by an online discussion that I didn't participate in which the refutation has prevented me from spreading wrong stuff or thinking wrong things, but you never find out about it. So, I'm not quite sure what it means for an argument to get settled and whether I would prefer whatever that means to what we have right now, which is, a lot of chaos and a lot of wrong information. But you can dig for it. I'm not sure I want things to get settled.
Well, all right, look. The roots of your suspicion of not wanting things settled can be found probably in a very healthy worry about mediated discourse turning into tyranny. The experts, the professionals, and notice that one of my major themes, even though I go back and I talk to the CIA, the Defense Department, about how to anticipate better, nevertheless, one of my major themes is the empowerment of the citizenry. And one of the things I talk about is the Enlightenment institutions that harness competitiveness. If you really want, through my website, contact me. It's a little hard to find. It's on my website. Try Disputation Arenas Bryn. Okay? It's a more scholarly paper about how we could accomplish what I'm talking about. And that is, turn portions of the internet into arenas for concepts, like markets are arenas for products and services. Like science is an arena for determining truth about the world. Like law courts are arenas for dealing with justice, and democracy is an arena for policy. I talk about the fifth accountability arena being one that can just explore concepts and start us down the path of being able to rapidly see the accelerating change around us, digest the data, and come up with tentatively, prioritized lists, not even lists, but market-generated, ranked by reputation, perhaps, concepts that are just generally more likely to appear in the course of discourse than the bad ones. Now, what you described is how you as an individual, while trawling around in this morass, this ever-increasing storm, have found it a growth experience. Duh! And I've always found that one of the most beautiful words in the English language. Duh! We all in this room do that. I want something more. I have kids, I have a civilization, I am constantly inundated with crazy optimism from one side of me and storms of pessimism on the other side, and I'm sick of it. I'm a pragmatist. I want stuff solved. And as long as we are weighed down by one of the worst metaphors ever in the history of the human mind, the so-called left-right political axis, which we should abandon if for no other reason than because it's French. Look, I lived in Paris for a year and a half. Je crois que c'est absolument fou. The point is that if we can't get rid of that piece of shit, then we can't get rid of anything. And that piece of garbage is harming us now. I need problems solved. And I need the really, 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 really bad ideas to get out of the way. And thank God for Snopes. Yeah, some bad things do go away enough.
But if we, what if the big contribution of the internet is it means that we're evolving a generation of people with better bullshit detectors? That seems like a better contribution than we could have ever hoped for.
Look, I have said again and again and again, we've gotten smarter. Every time we've gotten these things, we've gotten smarter. But we've passed through crises in order to get smarter. So, I just want better tools. And you know what? Even if you're right, the better tools of discourse will just help you be more right. I don't think we're that far apart. I just don't want to rely on people who are getting more and more shallow-minded and their distraction index is getting wider and wider and wider. I'm not going to count on that. I don't think that shallow-minded distraction in all direction. Linda Stone called it continuous partial attention. We're going to get prosthetics that are going to enable us to pay attention to more things. I want to start inventing those prosthetics. What I'm good at is not the coding. What I'm good at is noticing what we haven't done. Any other questions? By the way, challenging guy.
Yeah, he is. Oh, yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned Snopes, which has one very direct vertical for
for truth or non-truth, and you talk about tyrannical decision-making process. I'm curious how Wikipedia does or does not, especially with its discussion section, match or not match a lot of what you're talking about.
Well, for one thing, I believe in gratitude. I think that ingratitude is one of the most churlish traits, which is why when one political party gave me a keynote at one of its conventions, I predicted that half of the people in the audience, half of the guys in the audience would give me a standing ovation and defend me against the other half that tried to lynch me, and I just gave you a clue as to which party that was by the fact that they were all male. I'm not that important. It was the Libertarians. I have given speeches to lesser bodies in the other parties, but what was my point? Oh, yes. Accountability. What was it again?
I was asking you about Wikipedia.
Wikipedia, right. I believe in gratitude. And so one of the problems with our friends, the libertarians, is that they hypothesize that tearing down the core elements of the civilization that has created more libertarians than any other would immediately result in more libertarians. This does not make logical sense. Even though I share the ultimate dream of the withering away of the state and the empowerment of individuals, all children, being so smart and empowered that they can simply compete with each other joyfully or cooperate with each other joyfully, depending upon whether you want the Marxist approach to the withering or the way of the state or the libertarian approach, but they all wind up creepily at the same place. The point is that throughout human history, 99% of the free markets were destroyed by an enemy that today's libertarians refused to recognize. Fewer than 1% were destroyed by socialism or peasant revolts or bureaucrats. 99% were destroyed by oligarchs, feudal lords and kings. And to ignore that enemy just because you've read Ayn Rand is pretty dumb. And to be ungrateful to the civilization that made us to the point where we can talk about libertarian paradise. In other words, I stood in front of 3,000 or 4,000 libertarians and raised my glass to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. As I have said many times, I do try hard to be set on fire. Now, Wikipedia. I do not like to be ungrateful to something that beautiful and that useful. I don't think it's for me to be doctrinaire about the methodologies that they use. I think they keep as light a hand as they feel they can. But they recently had to ban some organized groups that were systematically getting tens of thousands of people to swarm certain sites and make changes that were not neutral. Personally, I'm astonished. When you see a dog, talking dog, interviewed on Leno, and he has a severe speech impediment, what fact strikes you?
A talking dog.
The fact that he has a speech impediment or the fact that you're looking at a talking dog? That's how I look at Wikipedia. Anybody else? Yeah.
I would like to make a point about what you said about that professionalization can't continue. But I think that with quite a number of people on this planet living on $1 or $2 a day, there's quite some room at the top.
Yes, but don't forget, they'll need the same ratio of professionals as we. So what's going on in America?
Oh, you were talking about America?
No. What I'm talking about is that they are undergoing their own accelerating portion of the professionalization curve that we went through a generation ago. just because they're a generation behind us in that accelerating curve doesn't mean you have don't have an intrinsic wall. And let's also bear in mind that the image of the world as being 90% in poverty is obsolete.
I know.
Yeah. We have to, if we're going to fix what's left, the pain that's left, we have to also notice the things that have happened. And one of the things that has happened recently, one of the reasons why we have this current financial crisis, is because America went to the wall to do one of the greatest things that it has ever done, that any nation has ever done. Yes, we fought fascism. Yes, we held communism still without nuclear war until the fever broke. We did a lot of great accomplishments. Yes, we went to the moon and showed the way for fighting racism and sexism. But there's only one thing that America did that was historically important. And that is George Marshall, Dean Acheson, Harry Truman, when Pax Americana was formed, they made a decision that no previous empire has ever made. Instead of creating a mercantilist trade pattern that would favor the home industries, they created an anti-mercantilist trade pattern that favored overseas industries. The result was a process by which Americans lifted up the world by buying several tens of trillion dollars worth of crap we never needed. Now, anybody who can look at the world and not realize that that is the biggest thing that has transformed the world. It certainly transformed the oceans by filling them with crap. So you see how I can be contrarian even with myself. Now, was this a form of foreign aid? Do we get moral points for having fun spending ourselves into the poorhouse by all that crap? I don't know. All I can do is look at the effects. And the effect is that most of the planet Earth today, most of the population, is middle class. By some definition, that is an amazing accomplishment. Yeah.
So going back to the new age of amateurs, that's actually very interesting because you talked about how it was so difficult to get back to a basic box. And I'm sure you've read Stevenson's rant on GUIs, right? In the beginning with the command line, I think it was called.
Yes.
And I got to say, you know, I'm looking at me and hearing everybody in the room is very familiar with the command line, but you go next door to whatever that other conference was and I don't know how many people I've ever seen a command line. And it does feel like we have a split and you have people who can do things and you have people who just can't and have no interest.
When America sent soldiers off to World War II, most of the divisions were infantry divisions, while America's factories cranked up. And then they just simply sent huge numbers of tanks and trucks. And they would arrive and say, okay, now you're a mechanized division. Now you're an armored division. With very little preparation. Why? Because 80% of the young men had tinkered with the fashionable technology of their time. And they knew how to take care of the equipment. My sons, just last night, built from kits, crystal radios. And I told them about the era when that's all that boys would do. And just 20 years ago, all that the smart boys would do was mess with computers on the command line. Now, where's our seed corn? Who knows how to do machine code who doesn't work for Intel? Who knows how to do assembler who doesn't work for... Who does assembler? Yeah, okay, a couple of you guys. I mean, when I did my doctoral dissertation, I had to pray every time I picked up this bunch of cards and bring it over to the reader. Yeah, I'm that old. Did you have another question?
So, are we saying that it's just okay to have a few people who are specialized and still know how to do assembler? Or what are we saying?
We need the way in which we can get the added depth of expertise in our civilization is what I coined in both my novel Earth and The Transparent Society as the age of amateurs. We're capable of more. That's what all this divided attention should be about. It's not just wee, opinion, 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 opinion. It should also be about one of the greatest things about being human. You have your vocation, the thing that gets you money. It should be something you like. And then you have your avocation. And then two or three hobbies. And you love being good at them too. Now, naturally, I believe in this model because I became a scientist, I became an engineer, I was pretty good at it, and I had my avocation of being a science fiction author, and the tail wagged the dog. It took over. Civilization was willing to pay me a lot more to spin stories than it ever did to find out what's true. And who am I to argue with civilization? But what I'm trying to say to you is this: an airline mechanic or an airline pilot can be an amateur firefighter. A dentist can be an amateur pilot who can step in if one of those movie scenarios happens on an airplane. This is where we're going to get our depth. This is where we're going to get our resilience. And I see very little in the way of decisions being made at the highest levels in the institutions, in the markets, or among the people, that this is what we're gonna do. I've written three or four science fiction stories about this, and you can find some of them at davidbryn.com.
Thank you, I'll be sure to check it out.
All right. Oh, I guess this may be the last question.
Okay. So when you talk about the...
Thank you for coming.
When you talk about the younger generation being having a limited attention span, right, and looking at all sorts of information, no?
Not the younger generation, all of us.
All of us, okay.
Except when we're busy on our professions.
Okay, so, okay, but my question was, what do you think that generation will look like in maybe 30 years? How would they change, and when they have their own David Brin come up and speak, what would he talk about?
Well, what do I hope? I hope my friends in the singularity community are at least somewhat right about 30 years from now. You know, they say, my objective in life is to live long enough to live forever. They figure if you live another 30, 40 years, then you'll probably get all filled with nano machines that'll clean out your system, and then you'll be made a new body made for you and all that sort of stuff. And I roll my eyes and say, I'm the science fiction author here. Leave me alone. For one thing, I hate these guys. They're some of my best friends, but look, think about what they're saying. They're saying that when death inevitably knocks on your door, you won't have the solace of saying, at least it happens to everybody. Instead, you'll say to yourself, but you promised. And maybe people 10 years younger than me will be in time. I hate these guys. What do I think kids will be like 30 years from now? Well, every time my kids say, well, I'll be a better dad than you, I say, good. That's exactly what I was aiming for. And you'll owe it all to me. That's the objective. To make the positive sum game apply rapidly to the generations. That's how we'll get libertarian paradise. Not by tearing down the government, but by building up all children so that they just don't need much government anymore. All children, everywhere. If they're vastly better than us, if they continue this incredible story of human beings turning out to be just smart. smarter. Because that's what I showed you. Vastly smarter than evolution could possibly explain. If we continue this and then start augmenting ourselves with these machines, dang, we're going to go where no one has gone before. But in order to do that, we have to solve pragmatic problems that enable our kids to be a little less flighty and a little less dopey. They're smart enough. They'll use any tool we give them. But right now, they're really a pack of ninnies. And it's because of what we feed them. And that's why I tried to patent some of these simple techniques that we use in daily life. Yes, Daniel.
Well, I was going to make this rhetorical, but I'll ask it as a serious question. And by the way, I do need to announce that after this talk, we're going to be shutting off the wireless network. Given that you probably could go on a screed for at least 20 minutes about reality television, what do you think the odds are that we will become the Marching Morons?
Well, the Marching Morons is a famous novel, Frederick Pohl and Kuttner, or was it Pohl and... the notion that the scenario that I described comes true. At some point, the new media simply control us. In the 50s, it was television when this novel was created. And basically, people are controlled pretty much by the advertising, by the messages. Instead, we got calluses to advertising, and we became skeptical. And we became aware of what advertising can do, and we argued with each other about the advertising. But eventually, will they find the buttons? Will they find the buttons to push that will put us under thrall of some permanent feudalist aristocracy forever? Certainly, Rupert Murdoch's looking for them. The point is, ...2,500 years ago, the experiment was run for the first time. If you count the Tower of Babel, maybe the second time, in Periclean Athens. And if you read Thucydides, who was an enemy of the Periclean democracy, but an honest man, unlike Plato. Plato, who became the great propagandist against democracy, against accountability, for two millennia. But Thucydides quoted Pericles verbatim when Pericles gave the greatest argument for the notion of accountability arenas, the notion that each of us is delusional, but that we can find our way through criticism. Socrates, Buddha, Jesus, they all said, you cannot know what this is. Your senses are flawed. Reality is gritty. You can never figure out what's real. Therefore, give up and seek something better on another plane, through the right incantations, through abnegation of the self, through logic and reason, until Galileo came along and said, you're right. I cannot know what this is. My eyesight is poor. My subjective wishes interfere and color over what's objectively there. I can never know what this is. But through experimentation, carving away of false hypotheses, exposing my hypotheses to criticism by others so that they will notice my delusions, which I am incapable of noticing, I can find out what this is not. And that is progress. That's what science does. It never shows what is. It proves what is not. And here's the great thing. In an open civilization, you can expose your ideas to the world, and other people will be glad to provide you with the criticism that you need in order to pierce your delusions. And they'll do it for you for free. And you will be happy to return the favor. And that's how it works. That's how these accountability arenas work. It's neither cooperation nor competition, but a blending of them, a layering of them, like in The Lion King, the circle of life, where competition at one level becomes cooperation at the other level. And it turns out that's exactly what goes on in our own brains. And harnessing this is the glory of this civilization. And Pericles talked about that. He saw it. And people talk about, oh, if only they hadn't had the plague, if only the Peloponnesian War, they were doomed. They were struggling against an enemy vastly greater than democracy could possibly have dealt with the level of primitive technology and abilities that they had in those days. We're all descended from the harems of guys who picked up metal implements every time human civilization discovered metallurgy and agriculture. Some guys picked up metal implements and took other men's women and wheat and expanded their reproductive success because of it. And we're all descended from those guys. And anybody who thinks that feudalism isn't the natural human social order had better come up with another explanation for why we all love fairy tales about kings. No, Pericles never stood a chance. And God help us, somebody may be saying the same damn thing 2,000 years from now. When they're doing this little mind replays of me standing here, or the Federalist Papers, or whatever it is. They never stood a chance. Read Stapleton's Last and First of Men to read that poignantly portrayed. Or, because I promise you, if we fail in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the lords, the oligarchs won't let it be tried again. For another 2,000 years. But if we succeed, then we'll be building that tower. And I think this time it'll be good, and nothing will be denied us. Thanks a lot.